Welcome to Our Takes. This is a half-hour film podcast by two guys who watch movies when they have the chance. I'm Jason.
I'm John.
And we're not experts, but we love talking about movies when we have the time. And we hope you enjoy, love listening to us talk about movies. So sit back, enjoy, and set your expectations reasonably low because we may meet them. So, John, how you doing?
You know, I'm doing well. I wanted to take a minute to start off the podcast just recognizing Mike Nichols, recently passed away. And I was sad to hear that.
Yeah.
But wanted to recognize that and wonder, do you have a favorite Mike Nichols movie?
Yeah, actually, it's one that I actually posted some stuff about on Facebook. I was in my junior or senior year of college, and I was house sitting for a professor. And this is the first time I ever watched The Graduate.
Mm-hmm.
Blew me away. The opening shot of The Graduate, of him on the jet and coming down the people mover. That movie introduced me to so much of what can be done with framing of camera angles, scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's a very rich, Buck Henry did the screenplay for that. It's very rich with dialogue and hilarious. But the camera angles, the scuba diving stuff, the tight focuses at times, and then there's that one great shot of Mrs. Robinson when Ben comes and tells Mrs. Robinson's daughter about their, or I forget what he says to her, but she's waiting against this white wall and she goes, "Hello, Benjamin," and then it pans back. But all that is just, I just loved that movie. I mean, that is, you know, just really hit me like a meteor. I mean, it's just incredible. I would say number two would be probably Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Okay.
And, you know, I've not really got into some of the others, but I know he did Primary Colors.
Right.
And that was enjoyable too, but nothing to me ever hit the level as a Graduate, which is probably one of my favorite movies ever too. So how about you?
Well, let me blow my street cred here. I've never seen all of The Graduate. I've seen many clips. I know a lot of the famous scenes. Closer, I thought, just blew me away. That's
really?
Julia Roberts, Clive Owen, Natalie Portman, and Jude Law. Thought it was amazing. And I've always been really impressed with the performances in every movie I've seen of his. Very great actors, director.
Now, did that have any sort of inventive camera takes or angles?
It was more about the performances.
Okay.
Yeah, when I think about that movie visually, that's not what comes to mind.
Well, which is weird because he's not known, I don't think, as a very... It must have been a cinematographer or a camera person working on that because he's not, I don't think, known for these really out there, whatever types of takes. Because if you look at Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, it's basically a stage production.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where he got his chops, right?
And stage and continued to go back
Spamalot.
He did that.
Yeah. Okay. So, I think it's sad. And apparently he was working on stuff up until the very
mm-hmm.
end, too. So
yeah. So, anyway, we wanted to recognize that.
Yeah,
it's definitely a legendary film director.
Yep. So, what's the movie for this week?
Sure. Well, of all the genres, perhaps none puts the emphasis more firmly on the actor and the script as the courtroom drama.
True.
So, other than maybe romantic comedy, and I'm thinking of like Matthew McConaughey in Fool's Gold.
Oh, yeah.
But other than that, so today we're going to discuss entry in the courtroom drama canon, and that's Sidney Lumet's The Verdict.
Can I just say something real quick?
Absolutely.
This is the second time we've come back to Matthew McConaughey and Fool's Gold, I think, in our podcast. I think it's the second time.
I'm going to try to sneak it into every one. It's like Alfred Hitchcock popping up.
Okay, go ahead.
So in The Verdict, Paul Newman plays a once promising graduate of Boston College Law School who is now an alcoholic ambulance chaser who has lost all of his four cases over the last 3 years. As a favor, his former partner and friend, played by Jack Warden, gives him a medical malpractice case where it's all but assured that the defense will settle for a large amount. The case involves a young woman who was given a knockout anesthetic during childbirth and ends up in a coma. As he kind of stumbles his way through the preliminaries, he suddenly realizes that perhaps, after all, the case should go to court to punish the guilty, to get a decent settlement for his clients, and restore his standing as a lawyer. So again, that's The Verdict, Sidney Lumet.
Now, why I think we should eliminate one of the reasons we wanted to talk about this movie wasn't necessarily because of Lumet, or Paul Newman. It was mainly because of David Mamet. We both are kind of David Mamet fans.
Huge fans. Yeah.
And this was one of his very early screenplays for Hollywood. So this just definitely is that's one of the reasons we wanted to do this. So,
and I think as we talk about it, then you came across, I think AFI had it as like number four on the courtroom drama,
right,
best courtroom
right.
drama or something like that. So, real quick background on this before we get into it. So we mentioned the director, Mamet was the writer, one of his first screenplays. Besides Paul Newman, Charlotte Rampling and Jack Warden, the other kind of big names. Also Bruce Willis in a cameo as a courtroom extra.
The very end, yeah.
The Verdict was nominated for 5 Oscars, including Best Picture, Director, Actor, and Screenplay. So it was acclaimed. It didn't win any of those, but it was definitely...
It was a tough year, though. I think that was the same year as E.T.
I think that a lot of big ones there. So start off, I'm always interested in movies like this when you don't see them in their heyday, but kind of after the fact. Does it live up to the hype, and is it dated? And so I'm wondering, what was your take in general on this? And then do you feel like with the expectations you went into it, do you felt like they were met?
I think what's great about it, because the screenplay is so strong, is that it seems like there was a lot of stuff that was still relevant today. Extremely so, especially because one of the key things in this is a struggle with faith. And there's a theme of redemption and forgiveness. Well, not as much forgiveness, but redemption and a spiritual journey that Paul Newman, Francis, right? Is that his?
Right, Frank.
Frank kind of goes through this kind of journey. Of his soul, beginning literally in hell, I would say, of his own creation, and kind of journeying out of that through these kind of, I would say, spiritual epiphanies, realizations that he has, and also the fact that this is dealing with a case against a hospital that is under a diocese, and I just couldn't. I mean, we're watching this, and I said to my wife, "I'm like, oh." Well, that's relevant even today, you know,
right.
with molestation issues and things like that, and yet, I'm not going to say that there's not really a very horrible picture painted of the church. I don't think that's the case.
Right. No,
I don't think they painted them off these as caricatures of evil or in any way like that. But it did set up. It seemed so relevant today. In fact, there were some things in it that just seemed. I'm like, I would like to see these in more movies today. These certain ideas and things where there is a courtroom speech,
right.
but it's not the speeches that you sometimes hear about that you're going to see maybe in even a TV drama now, you know, or anything like that. So, yeah, I you know, as I said, we both didn't see it at the time when it came out, but I feel like I could definitely tell it's dated, obviously,
right?
But it didn't. It didn't stick that datedness in my face, and I didn't feel like it wasn't relevant.
Yeah.
Really hit home on me on several different levels, you know?
You know, tribute to Mamet. I just love David Mamet.
Yeah.
And his script, the fact that really holds up, and I think because there's some universal themes that aren't of the time. Like you said, it's interesting how much is still even more so. Like, I feel like he was kind of at the forefront of some of these issues. really, you know, it's kind of like the lone... hero going after like the institutional cynicism or corruption or
right.
whatever, and you think, oh my gosh, when you talk about like the hospital or managed care or whatever, and just, you know, even right to life stuff, it raises interesting issues.
Right.
I know that this story was, I think her name was Kathleen Quinlan.
Yeah, based on that case.
Excuse me.
A very different situation, actually.
Right.
Right.
But it's interesting that since that time, there's been a lot more cases like that have kind of captured the national attention. You know, I really, as a fan of Mamet, it was kind of fun to see some of his themes emerge. But he definitely, you know, a lot of his work revolves around purity or justice or truth. And about characters, you know, saying one thing and doing another versus broken characters, but that actually live by kind of that code.
Right.
And I thought they set that up. I mean, it was interesting to start this movie out. It's not like, you know, a lot of times you'll see stars. William Goldman talks about this in some of the books he's written. But, you know, oh, they're not really a bad guy. But this guy's literally like an ambulance chaser.
Right.
At the beginning of the movie, he's going to people's funerals he doesn't know to try to drum up business.
And pretends to know.
Right.
The worst
he really sets him up as like truly unlikable, not like cutesy movie unlikable, but you're like, well, really, he's not that bad. So I appreciated that, and that felt very Mammoth to me.
Right. I would say even all the way up until, like, I think when he meets with the doctor,
mm-hmm.
who's going to verify his case and against the diocese, and he's going to get a forkload of money from it, even through that whole thing, and he goes to the bar to celebrate. It's until that one scene, I think, if it's, you know, there's a very interesting scene when he goes up to the woman who had the over, or not the overdose, she was incorrectly medicated during birth, or during giving birth. He goes to take pictures of her. Mm-hmm. She's pretty much in a vegetative state.
Right.
And as he's snapping these Polaroids, he just stops. And
right.
then he looks at the Polaroids. And it just this, and he's stupefied. Like, he just sits
right.
and he just looks.
Right.
And then I think that is the beginning of this term, because then later he meets with the diocese and the and talks to them, and they essentially try to pay him off.
Right.
You know, there's this great scene when he said, "I came here to take your money. I took these pictures here to take your money," and that is a great dialogue, great scene. You know, and I don't know, that just really built up well. I think. A couple of those scenes really built up where that Mammoth builds that stuff up, where you've got him going in, taking these pictures, and then meeting them, and just this whole thing builds up. I don't know. It's just really well done.
You know, I would have loved to have seen more Mammoth and Lummit, whatever you call it, connections. Like, that scene really struck me because visually, there's not too many fancy things going on here. That scene was brilliant. And I suspect that might have been a director's choice versus script choice, where basically he goes in and with Polaroids, which is kind of interesting to see a Polaroid camera
right.
On film, he takes this picture and it basically holds on a single shot as that picture is exposed. And basically you're in the point of view of Paul Newman as the light kind of dawns on him as he kind of... It suddenly dawns on him, wait a minute, this isn't just a money grab, this is...
Right.
And I thought that was a brilliant moment, and visually, I thought right. that was just a really... A lot of times you can see stuff that you think, that was an amazingly executed shot, but it kind of takes you out of it. This, I thought, really had an emotional...
Yeah.
It really served the story.
Right,
so,
right.
There are a few things visually in this movie that kind of struck me. That was probably the biggest
mm-hmm.
one.
Oh, I was going to mention real quick, just one of the things I was listening to, I was watching the director's commentary, that all the colors in this were muted fall-like colors.
Mm.
And my wife, this kind of ties in with what she was saying. We were driving this morning and she talking about the movie, and she said, this movie is a lot about his spiritual journey.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about it, it's a death of oneself and a beginning of another.
Mm-hmm.
And as those parts of him start to die, other parts still linger. But, like, it would make even more sense if they used autumn colors because of the death,
mm-hmm.
dying, you know, and all
mm-hmm.
that. So I thought that was interesting. It kind of ties in to a lot of those colors. Because if you notice, as he progresses and he has these epiphanies, he's not always, like, in a bad sort of courtroom drama movie.
Yeah.
It'd be like, dude, you've got to get your act together. This is it. You're right. He has this epiphany, blah, blah, blah. And then it shows montage of him studying
and
working
right.
away.
Yeah.
This does not do that. He's still showing up late. He's still drinking.
He's still drinking.
He's still doing stuff that's not good for him. He's still sleeping around, you
right.
know? He's got this kind of booty call going on, you
right.
know, whatever. And so, I mean, he's still a mess. But he's got this strong conviction about what he believes to do is right. Right.
I love, and again, kudos to Mammoth on that. You're drawn to this character they set up as so unlikable, but he's on the side of truth and justice. And so, yeah, he's still drinking, he's still doing these other things, but in his brokenness, he is still doing the right thing when the church or the, you know what I mean, there's so many of these institutions,
mm-hmm.
the judge who's kind of in cahoots with this
eyebrows.
Other right. with the other lawyer who clearly, you know, tries to say, really, you should take this settlement,
right.
you know, and steer him away from that. Interestingly, getting back to my initial question about was this dated, I remembered, I'd forgotten about this. My dad, when I was growing up, used to tell me bedtime stories like this. He would go see movies and tell me. So he told me The Verdict.
No way!
Yeah. which is hilarious. I mean, obviously he cleaned up certain things, but one of the things I remember telling me at the time, this was like so controversial because of the Mamet dialogue and, oh, this is really rough language and, you know, it's rated R basically because of the language. I just thought, like, how tame this comes off now.
Right.
So that's something that I thought was kind of dated. I'm like, really, at the time, that was kind of controversial.
Did you find it interesting, though, when the language was used, though? It was pretty much one character that used it.
Right.
Jack Warden.
Right.
And which is Frank's partner.
Right.
And I just found that very interesting because every time they meet, he... And here's the thing about Mamet.
Yeah.
He doesn't, while he's known for using profanity, I think he uses it well.
I would agree.
And to effect.
Definitely. That's
and when
right.
this character uses it, he's passionate about his concern and worry about Frank
right.
losing everything. He's like, mm-hmm. I'm giving you these cases and you're throwing them away.
Right.
You're throwing them, you know, and he blankety-blank, he just keeps going off on this. And I thought that fit in well with his character here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, yeah, anyway, but yeah.
Another thing that was really interesting to me, wasn't expecting, I really saw a lot of Tom Cruise in Paul Newman, both how he looked, but in a lot of the mannerisms. I thought that was really interesting, because obviously, at least when I think of courtroom dramas, I think of A Few Good Men.
Right.
With an Aaron Sorkin script, which, you know, Aaron Sorkin's a great writer. And I wondered, you know, Tom Cruise was in Color of Money with
Paul
Newman.
Which is a sequel to The Hustler.
And that's the one that Paul Newman finally won his one and only Oscar for. And it made me wonder what sort of influence that might have had on Cruise's performance in Few Good Men. I had never thought that or noticed that before.
That's really good. I hadn't actually, wow, that's really good. I think that there's more of a restraint with Paul Newman in this, much more restraint. I mean,
right.
Yeah, Tom Cruise in A Few Good Men seems still to be more like, if I could use a canine, a chihuahua.
Right,
times,
right,
you know,
yeah.
Really quiet, then sulks, and then jumps up and gets
right.
really ferocious.
Right.
But I just never felt like I saw that with Paul. There is very much a defeated part about him.
Definitely.
Almost all the time.
Yeah, he's kind of a sad sack. I mean, again,
right.
Kind of a brave role for Newman to take as a star.
Right.
Yeah.
This almost could have been played by Walter Matthau.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
oh,
I mean,
right.
You
yeah.
know, I mean, shuffling around there, you know. And his speech at the end isn't, I mean, really, there is nothing in that speech that brings anything to light to the jury that's
right.
new. But he says something, he says, this is about the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And he keeps going back to that. And you know, as again, I was telling my wife and I were talking about this, she was saying that what the bishop, I think it was the bishop, I forget his name, he's the head of the diocese for the hospital.
Right.
And he says to one of the guys who was in the courtroom, one of the attorneys, I believe, when the girl comes in to testify, the nurse that they find, you know, whatever, he asks a question, he goes, but did they believe her? And he doesn't say, was that stuff dismissed, which is what James Mason, great role
I
in this.
I should have mentioned him, by
yeah,
the way, earlier.
Yep. Is the opposing attorney here for the diocese. It's not that he said, wipe this all away, get this off the record. This isn't. He goes, did they believe him?
Mm-hmm.
And that is what this movie is about.
That's right.
Belief and the change of it.
Right.
You know, and I think that's just, when we were talking about that, I was like, oh my gosh, you're absolutely right. Because he hits home. I mean, that bishop is not really painted to be evil. He kind of cuts to the quick of certain things.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, anyway, but yeah, just thinking about that. So, any more? I'm interested what else. You got a lot of notes there.
Well, one other thing, again, I'm jumping around here. I thought it was interesting. You may have come across this, or it might have been in the, you might have heard this in the special feature piece, but apparently Mamet's original script did not want to give you the final verdict. So I thought that was a funny. That's so Mamet to
it
me.
Is,
like,
it is.
I thought there's a line at some point where I'm like, you know, I'm not a cynical producer, but really, come on, you know.
Right.
But I guess it was so kind of focused on his journey that basically that wasn't the point about the verdict. It was about what he was doing. So. And then I think one of the producers said, if that's the case, we have to call it The Verdict with a question mark. So I thought that was a really funny trivia piece.
And this
so.
Kind of went through some big changes in the screenplay process. They didn't like Mammoths at first at all. Too gritty, too dark.
Mm-hmm.
And they went over to some other guy. Well, actually, they had another director on board. The director didn't like mammoth script, brought in somebody else. They hated that script.
Right.
Then another guy, director, went behind their back. I think it was Pollack, didn't he?
I think that's right. Yep.
Went behind their back with another writer.
Right.
And they said, you're out of here.
Right.
Then, who's the, Zanuck, came back in and said, okay, we're bringing in Sidney Lumet, and then we're bringing back, and he says, I want Mammoth script.
Right.
So it's kind of just had this, and I think that from the way Lumet talked in the movie, in the commentary, was that Mammoth was, should be owed a lot for a lot of the way the scenes built.
Huh,
one
sure.
on the other in terms of the tension
yeah.
and the way things were working. Now, he did give a lot of credit to Newman's chops for acting chops for a couple scenes, specifically when he comes back from going to the hospital the very first time. He comes back, I think, to the elevator, and he's just sitting there, and he notices the elevator's not working, and he kicks it. He said that's all Newman. He made that up. And the spray, the mouth spray thing, and the eye drops.
Okay.
That's all Newman's additional stuff there for what he believed that an alcoholic guy, functioning alcoholic. What I didn't know, and I couldn't remember, I think this is Lumet's, how do you say it, Lumet? Or
I think it's Lumet, but Lumet.
Was the pinball machine playing.
Okay.
That was a great, I mean, it was a great, if you look at it, it was a great frame.
Right.
On that window. I mean, the way the pinball machine comes down through the bottom, and then his body comes up, and then you have the top of the window. I don't know why, I just love that framing device of that scene. And that was, and Lumet was talking about how you do this when you're stressed. You do this when you're down to you play a game, you know. And right at the scene is building this great moment in the movie when things look really looking great before they get really dark again.
Right.
He scores really high on this pinball game, you know. So I just loved that. I love the pinball thing throughout it. You know, I thought that was great. And that, to me, that's a mammoth touch.
Yeah.
You know, and also Paul Newman's character and some others use some of these prophetic, parable sounding expressions. Well, when Charlotte Rampling kind of talks to Newman on the way out the bar, I think it's the second time maybe, or flirts with him.
Yeah.
And he looks back and he's sitting there talking to this guy, really tight shot, okay? And he looks back at her and looks at the other guys and goes, long is the road that, or something about the road is narrow and long and there are no turns or something like that.
Right.
I'm like, that's Mammoth.
Yeah.
Right there. He's throwing in stuff like that. Usually it's the bearded guy in a lot of his movies, Ricky.
Jay. Ricky Jay, the magician.
Yeah.
You know, I should say, just because someone out there may be listening and saying, Key and S, David Mamet. I don't know if we, you know, Mamet wrote The Untouchables, a great Chicago movie.
Yeah.
You and I are both big fans of the work that he's directed. I mean, he wrote Glengarry Glen Ross, who won a Pulitzer on the stage. He also wrote the script, I believe, for the movie. Great Alec Baldwin speech in that. He stayed in Maine.
Right.
Spartan. He did the Phil Spector movie, which was really good. I think HBO or Showtime did recently.
TV show The Unit, if you remember.
The Unit. And I know we're missing some other big hitters.
He's touched up so many screenplays, it's probably just... he's probably uncredited as touching up so many screenplays.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think he might have done one of the Tom Clancy touch-ups, too.
Okay.
Hunt for Red October or one of those.
Wag the Dog's another one that's you know... great.
Right.
So you may be like, oh, I don't know that name or know that much about him, but you might know some of those movies and understand.
He's a Chicago guy, right? Chicago,
right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Interestingly, a couple of things I wanted to mention about this, and I was, I've always been interested in film noirs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always also loved this painter, Caravaggio, from Italy in the 16th century. Anyway, he kind of invented this style of lighting called chiaroscuro.
Okay.
And as I'm listening to this commentary, you notice there's a couple scenes in the movie that are just beautifully lit, where the light is very natural, and you can't see parts of their faces, you can only see the front. So I think one of them is actually while Paul Newman is talking with Charlotte Rampling's character, you can see their faces, but behind them it's darkness and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I was heavily influenced by... he said chiaroscuro, and I was like, oh my gosh, because I've loved that stuff. And and he said, yeah, I actually bought like a really expensive Caravaggio book and had my director of photography and I went through this and said, we want to do lighting like this. So a lot of the lighting in this movie is completely natural.
Okay.
From one angle, actually. I shouldn't say all natural, but it's from one angle.
Okay.
So while you're looking at a character, you may be like, okay, why don't... And there were a couple things like... specifically the pinball machine.
Right.
If you notice the lighting in that, it's all from the window pretty much. Mm-hmm. And back of his body in the area behind the bar is all dark.
Okay.
Just as it kind of would be naturally in a lot of ways. So I thought that was kind of interesting. He used a very... It matched the script of being gritty and real.
Yeah.
You know? So I really like that. He said there's only one scene in the movie where he didn't use autumn colors and didn't use that. And that was... He said it was blue. He used blue. And I couldn't figure out what that was. I listened to the commentary. I'm guessing it's the scene when he walks outside and it's snow everywhere.
Oh, okay.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
He was going out to meet.
Yes.
I think he's had a pretty
bad
defeat.
Right.
And, it was just snow everywhere. Yeah, he's lost touch with... He's trying to get all these people to come up and be a witness for him, and he can't find anybody.
Right,
because the diocese or the attorney. By the way, we just have to give credit to James Mason. James, I can't even do him. He's just a great actor. When he get on the screen, you just don't forget him.
Mm-hmm.
He is this great attorney with this huge amount of lawyers working for him. They work for the diocese. And even as a villain, if you want to call him that in this,
right.
He chews up the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
He just does. This whole thing, especially when he's briefing this doctor on how to testify. Oh, just great.
Right,
you know,
that was
just
a great scene. Just because reinforcing that theme again of kind of basically, you know, what's right and true, and then what we're going to paint the picture of what we want to
paint
look
the picture,
true.
Exactly.
The difference between what's true and what looks true. One final thing I did want to say, because, again, I really enjoy this movie. One thing that didn't work as well for me was the Charlotte Rampling character.
Yeah.
I thought her part was pretty underwritten, and actually I did not. There's a scene where she gets slapped, and that I was disturbed by that. I felt like, I don't know. That just didn't work for me. I was kind of bothered. I felt it was kind of misogynistic almost how that went down. But.
Yeah, it did bother me. The slapping scene, of course, bothered me. I mean, and I kept trying to think, okay, context, time period, but it's early 80s. It's still not
right.
That long.
Right. It was kind of like, well, she deserved this. And I don't know.
Right. So. But I will say this. My wife brought up that she viewed the other attorney as this kind of satanic figure in a way of just this kind of he's always tempting him.
Right.
He's always setting up. He's in bed with all this. Like when they meet with the judge, he has his coat in the same wardrobe as the judge does.
Right.
You know, he's kind of always sending out these signals of you can give up anytime. You can give up anytime. And in some ways, the woman is an extension of that.
Right.
You know, another. And I don't want to reduce her down to just this object, but she clearly was like this temptation for him to keep him off track.
Right.
And the final scene, and I want to ask you about this.
Yeah.
I mean, the movie's been out for a while. I'm sorry, it's going to be a little bit of a spoiler, but
yeah.
He's sitting in his law office, and things are going better, I'll say that much. And it's Charlotte Rampling calling him, and the phone just rings and rings and rings. What did you like that?
I thought about that. In one point, it felt almost unnecessary. But I appreciate that was definitely kind of a theatrical touch, I thought. You know, and he was drinking or smoking, I think, when that
he was smoking,
too,
yeah.
Right?
She was drinking, though,
right,
heavily, in bed,
right. Yeah.
Which is key.
I don't know. What was your take on that?
I felt like when it started, I said, this is going to end this way.
Right, yeah.
You know, I just felt like this is going to end this way. And I'm still thinking about it.
Right.
I'm still kind of wondering. My wife simply said, she's like, well, he's resisting temptation again.
Right.
He's resisting the ability to go back to that life that he had.
Right.
And I don't know. I don't know if it's over-spiritualizing it at all, but I do think that there is that aspect. And I think even Lummett said in the commentary that Dave has this understated ability to weave in spiritual language within his screenplays.
Mm.
Even in movies in plays that aren't exactly spiritual, but he has this ability.
Right.
And he does a lot. Like he'll weave in scripture in a way that's like great and just wow, you know. And he does this through this, and I think it brings on a certain level of meaning to him, you know, this journey that he's on. So one other thing I wanted to mention, one of my favorite scenes in this movie, there were a couple that are great shots, I thought. One of them is after he can't find Dr. Huber, Gruber. Actually, I keep thinking of MacGruber every time can't find the Dr. Gruber, who's a very key person to have in this trial. He comes back to his law office. The camera is set up in the corner and looking up. And as he enters, he's in the distance. And then Jack Warden's character comes in. And all of it, that one shot, is all that. Mm-hmm. That them talking and frantically calling people against darkness, like not a lot of light in that room. I really like that scene. And I even noticed at one point, if you look at the way the dimensions are, the chair at their desk is as tall as they are. So they're very small, almost lost, desperate,
right,
scurrying in the corner, trying to figure out what to do, you know? And I just, I really like the way that was framed. It just really stuck out to me. And then there was another scene when he comes back to, I think it's her hotel room, and there's this dialogue back and forth across the bed, a shot of her over his shoulder and a shot of him over his shoulder. And each time, each person looks a different size. I just, I don't know. Those are scenes that just kind of in my mind stuck out to me because it was effective in working with the dialogue.
There were a lot of subtle things like that that I thought really kind of enhanced what was going on there.
But overall, I recommend this. There is some profanity, not much. I think that's the main reason why it would have been rated on. I can't think of any other reason. The content is mature stuff, but it's really a good movie, worth continuing to discuss. I'm still thinking about it. I'm still processing, you know, things. But anything else you want to add?
Nope. I think that's it. I would recommend this, and I'm looking forward to whatever's next for Mammoth.
Cool. Yeah. Okay. Now we come to outtakes, a section of the podcast where we ask a question no one is asking except us, and we try to give an answer that is slightly humorous and unscripted. You got one there for
us? Yeah, so the question is, weigh in on the George Lucas Museum controversy. It's, you know, Chicago won over San Francisco to get this, and now there's, I think they're suing because it's taking up the open space by the lakefront. So what do you think? Are you pro George Lucas Museum, or...
You know, it's really hard to be anti-George Lucas Museum, for me. But, like, I mean, he's hosed a lot of my dream, my childhood with those horrible prequels that came out. But apart from that, I mean, if it is what I think it is, when it's, and I don't know what it is exactly, if it's going to be sort of a museum of sets and costumes and things like that, I'm really excited about it coming. Yeah. I don't know how I feel about where it's going to be. I think the building looks beautiful, and I think it would be interesting to add that to our landscape, our, you know. I thought this was, I don't know. There's part of me that, again, I don't know as much as you. Maybe you can add some more, but I feel like everybody was hoping and championing for this coming here. And as soon as it gets here, everybody's already finding a thing to complain about it already. And I'm like, are you serious? You know, and so... Maybe you can add, like, you have some more information.
You know, I don't have much information, but I'll say this. Build the museum. If it was anything else, I'd be like, let's protect the open space. But it's George Lucas. It's Star Wars. We got to have that here. Now, if I'm driving down Lakeshore Drive and I see, like, a huge Jar Jar Binks head or, like, Howard the Duck or something, I mean, you never know. There could be a Lucas misstep that could be, you know, horrendous. But assuming that's not the case, I think it's awesome that we have it here. And like, build it. I want to take my kids.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Good. Good question. Well, thanks for downloading the podcast. And if you're still listening, we are especially grateful you made it this far. We hope you enjoyed your time. Please rate us on iTunes. And I just want to say the whole iTunes rating thing, it's not just for our egos. The more you rate the podcast, actually it bumps it up and gets some more visibility out there in iTunes for other people to listen to. So it's not just like, oh, we don't know if you like us, and we're really insecure. We're going to do this because we want to find good reasons to talk about movies that we love. So we love doing this anyway. But if you rate us, then more people can hear us talk and blab on about movies. So tell your friends, families, and acquaintances. We'd prefer nice recommendations, but we want you to be honest. So, well, this is Jason. And
I'm John.
And in case you don't hear from us again, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.